This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unafawakin.
This week, Google fights on Amazon's turf, the collateral damage behind NSA target searches, the TSA's new rule for electronic gadgets, we know what the iPhone 6's screen looks like, and we think... All this and more next. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and you can leave us a review there in our show notes. And all of our subscription links are also in our show notes. Join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down, and write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. Our show's also on Stitcher at Stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the hot topics, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And this week, I want to welcome Tosin back from your vacation. You went to, not a vacation, but you went on a business trip to Tokyo recently. And I'm anxious to hear about some of the stuff that you saw there, in particular, anything, you know, tech or geek related that you saw there.
Yeah, no, I went to Japan and got to hide on, got some time to explore both sides of Japan, Tokyo as well as near Osaka. And I think there's a lot of little tech in there that I found pretty amazing, but also some big things too. So just hopping right into it, one of the very small things that I noticed was the vending machines. I know a lot of people talk about the vending machines, but it's pretty amazing when you actually get to see one, because it really offers a whole nother degree of beverages and other sorts of things to consumers out there. So, and they're all over the place. So for example, in one vending machine that I saw, there must have been, you know, 5 different types of coffee, 4 different types of teas, including energy drinks, as well as water and various sodas with various sort of flavors. And it was really sort of amazing that they were able to contain all of that with it and keep it running seamlessly and pretty smoothly. And the other really interesting and unique thing I heard, and I don't know if I've heard of this in other states, at least in the U.S., mm-hmm. is that whenever there's an emergency, all the vending machines in the area become free. So that users, wow. so that people have something to drink, and you know, in case you may not have water or other things to that you can use. So that was one of the little things that I found pretty amazing.
How prominent were vending machines? Like, for instance, I as a New Yorker and as someone who lives in a more suburban place now, I don't see many vending machines. So from like a cultural perspective, how many vending machines? I mean, like, what's the kind of per capita? You see one every corner, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I feel like it was, like, every block. Like, almost every block, I would turn around the corner and I'd see a vending machine. So if I ever really wanted a drink, it was accessible and available. It was really that sort of tightly well-knit together.
Gotcha.
I have to be the ugly gaijin and ask this question, because
they don't have them
that was like an urban legend when I was growing up.
They don't have them.
No more. All right.
don't be smirked. Okay.
I'm going to assume I know what you're talking
about. And don't
besmirch
the podcast by answering it. Don't besmirch the podcast.
Well, nice to know that it's just an urban legend, I suppose.
You're going to get a bunch of listener feedback. You're like, what are you talking about?
You know what we're talking about. Come on.
Suffice it to say that even if that does happen, it is not mainstream.
Sure. I'm sure in certain locations. You also saw the giant Gundam, right?
Yes. So that's one of the large tech that I saw was this. From what I was hearing, it's a scale replica of what a Gundam actually should be. And it was so amazing.
Scale replica, as in like a scale replica? Is it like A half scale replica or a full scale replica?
Full scale replica, okay. Based off the, I guess, show's measurements.
That's
so
insane.
It was literally taller than the mall that was next door, and the mall had, you know, seven levels, or it was very large. When I first like decided to go check it out, I was sort of the mindset that, oh, it'd be this like stationary statue that would be, you know, okay to look at, but just something really quick. They have this large video screen behind it, where they're showing like Gundam, part of the Gundam shows. Maybe it might have been an anime music video for Gundam. Lights were flashing. It's full of lights all over the actual Gundam. The head turns. It has like smoke or fog from the rocket boosters on the back, which also light up.
It doesn't actually fire rockets.
No, not that I know of.
That's disappointing. Not that you know of, yeah.
Yeah, not that I know of. It may actually be a Japanese defense weapon that we just don't secretly know about.
But yeah, what's interesting... Go ahead.
No, I was just simply by being there, I was actually really compelled to start watching Gundam, because I've only seen, you know, bits and pieces here and there, and I actually kind of want to check it out now.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about the Gundam in Tokyo Park. It's 18 meters tall. It's crazy huge. It basically looks like a giant Voltron for people not familiar with Gundam. What's really cool about it is that today, Wednesday, they basically had a 35-year celebration about it right then and right there. And their next ideas are reaching out to the public, to the crowdsource methods for how they can make a giant Gundam the same size that could do some moving, arms moving, whatever, poses, I don't know. So, you know, fandom making technology happen. You got to love it.
I love that, too. That's and we've talked about this before. That's Google's whole theory behind their R&D is making Star Trek happen for real. So sometimes it works to great advantage. So I'm glad that's...
Yeah. So much of the tech that we have today, you know, you look at your avatar on the little blinking blue dot on the map or whatever. So much of that stuff today is based on things like Dungeons and Dragons and some more early paradigms of situational, where you are, what's going on kind of stuff. And that's, you know, it's what geeks do. I mean, we had the flip phone from Star Trek. We had the L-Car system, which is a lot like the capacitive touchscreen stuff we use today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the science fiction is there to drive us forward. And while a lot of people are saying, well, science fiction doesn't matter anymore because we're living in the future, only reason we're living in the future is because we dreamed it up in the first place. So I'm definitely down with giant mechanized robots.
Mm-hmm. So now, just to cover a few extra things that I'm just going to quickly rattle off that were pretty cool. I was in the tech distro. It was within the Tokyo area. And Sega had this, I think it was four floors of gaming. So it's like an arcade, which brought back some serious memories with a lot of new tech in there. A lot of different types of like beat games, as well as even card games where you lay cards on the table and it affects the screen, like this card FIFA game, which is pretty cool. Also in that area, and I'll probably not be pronouncing this properly, but it's Yodobashi Akiba, which is just this really large, basically a Best Buy. I think it's maybe eight or nine floors, something like that, where each floor is dedicated to a different sort of tech. So, for example, the Gundams, which I got Dwayne while I was in my trip, are from floor 7, which is just the toy floor. You can imagine, like, this large structure, and I can share some photos where it's just all dedicated to toys on that one floor.
Wow. Nine floors of tech. That sounds like my mecca.
It was pretty remarkable, and yeah. So overall, a very interesting trip, a very kind of cool trip to see what was see the differences between cultures and differences between what they had. The last thing I'll touch upon is the robot restaurant, which is this really crazy event where it's basically sort of like two rows or three rows. You have to make reservations in advance because it sells out. And it's a very narrow channel in the middle. And they have basically a performance with women beating drums and people driving like huge mechanized robots. For example, a shark that at some point comes out and eats people, and like a giant snake that shoots out things and all sorts of, it was very wild, but pretty awesome given that I'm also trying to build Nartu and watching people have these like huge things that they're driving around.
Is this similar to like the mecha jousting that they have, in the Bay Area sometimes?
To a certain degree, some of that. But another degree is it's really like a performance. And it's a it's more, I guess, theatrical. But the sophistication of these robots are pretty huge in terms of the size of everything that's being mechanism and the small area that they're working with. It's literally right in your face. They actually, at a point, I was in the front row and they walk around and make sure people A, have their feet behind the bar, and you have to make sure that you're sitting back in your seat because there are things that will come right by your face.
Wow.
Just because it's, there's not that much space. So.
Wow. Very cool. I'm very jealous. I've always wanted to make a trip to Japan, and until then I get to live vicariously through you and other people who have.
It's definitely worth a trip. I would, if you're on the fence about it, I'd say go out, venture out, and check out something new.
One day, one day. Dwayne, how about yourself? What can what have you been playing with this week?
I've been excited about playing with the Gundams that Tosin got back, got from me in Japan. I have a little workshop, so I'll put those together. But in the meantime, I've been checking out this Knights of Cydonia. It's a Netflix exclusive on Netflix streaming. They've been promoting it pretty heavily when you log on. And what it is basically a giant robot anime. At first, I was like, whatever, run-of-the-mill giant robot anime. But then again, I hadn't really watched one since Razaphon back in like 2000-something, the first decade of this millennium. So I checked it out, and I gotta say, for the first several episodes I watched, I was pretty impressed. It's if you like giant robot kind of stuff, if you like Macross or Gundam from the 70s, if you ever had any wish to see Neon Genesis Evangelion but have been like, man, this shit is way too heavy, this is the show for you, because it definitely deals with some anti-hero stuff without getting kind of bogged down in some of the psychological stuff that that series deals with. And the action is pretty fantastic, especially because it's easy. You can follow it. You're not just kind of overwhelmed by exploding things.
Sure.
So, I gotta say, it's a pretty compelling story. The season covers, I think, volume one of the manga. So, I've already began looking around, and I think Barnes & Noble has the rest of the books. So, I might pick them up when I'm done watching this.
So, like other Netflix shows, the entire series is up at once, so that you can look at, so you can see it all at once and stream it all at once.
Season one, yeah.
Season one.
So, season one or volume one or whatever they're calling it, it's all up, the 20 something episodes, and it's definitely a binge watcher. Each episode's only half an hour, so there's not a lot to commit to, and the first part of every following episode is kind of an edited recap, not quite a last time on, but sort of like an overlap of storytelling, which actually helps, especially when you glance away from the screen for a moment or whatever.
Yeah, no, I've also been watching that series because when I got back from Japan, I was like, whoa, Netflix has a new anime series that they're kind of sponsoring. So I was interested. The
you didn't
sound
want to
is
go through cultural withdrawal too heavily.
Yes, yes. That's part of my fixing my jet lag, among other things. And one of the things that has amazed me about the show so far is really the sound design, because they are really taking quite great use of the 5.1, and I'm loving hearing each element as ships whiz by or communications hurry along during the various tunnels. I will say at the very beginning, it took me – I did have to reference Wikipedia for a little bit to keep track of some of the female characters, just because there are some similarities in look. And so I was –
They differentiate them not by face but by hair color. and haircut.
Yes.
That's like a regular – that's like one of those anime hurdles you have to get around. In addition to the fact that there's like usually 7 different technologies that aren't going to be translated in the subtitles. They're just going to be like a 6-syllable Japanese word. So you just kind of have to like – I don't know. I feel like I play a game of memory every time I start watching one of these series. What I do like about the series, the Netflix presentation of it, is that, you know, it's got – The obviously the Japanese language track is impressive. You know, you've got these dedicated actors to this one type of cinematic experience. They just focus on voicing anime characters, and they're very good. The English is pretty good too. And the reason I checked out the English, for those anime lovers who are like, why would you even do that, is mostly because there's certain times when I'm watching the show, but I'm also having to look away from the screen. Like, I might be folding clothes. I might be doing, I might be working on a gadget in front of me or whatever.
Sure.
Screwdrivers or whatever. So I can't read. And if I can't read, I don't know. But yeah, so the English is pretty passable, but the Japanese track is really quite tight. The characters are forceful, especially the female characters. It's good. It's got a lot of strong female characters, which is nice for a Japanese space opera kind of thing.
And it sounds like Netflix may have helped with some of those translations, or at least after the credits at the end, there are some additional credits for the various languages that are available, I think, on Netflix for other regions.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
You know what I'm curious about is that we've talked on the show before about how meticulous Netflix is in choosing their series, or at least the series that they have that they produce, and I'm not sure so much about the series that they sponsor as exclusive Netflix, but it's all based on user data. So I'm wondering what the criteria was for deciding to sponsor this particular anime and not above any other ones that they could have.
Well, I think there are a couple things. So first off, you know, when it comes to their homebrew productions, you know, they're going to be looking at data and putting things together based around that data and the available talent. I think when it comes to sponsoring things, it's got to be more lax. They don't have complete creative control over that kind of stuff. And I mean, that's a good thing. We'll get into this later when we're talking about Amazon, but a world in which you're creating stuff based on existing genres and kind of like existing frameworks for users to answer survey data is not a place where you'll find new innovative. You might find a lot of iterative. What makes this series pretty compelling is that there's a certain reinvention of the giant robot here. Not quite as big as in Neon Genesis Evangelion, but it plays homage to that particular series in several ways. And I think if you're into manga and if you're into mecha manga, you'll find that the production values are incredibly high. This is the kind of manga that this is the kind of anime that when you look at Akira, you know, 25 years ago, you're looking at Akira and saying, "Wow, these production values are fantastic." Or Miyazaki, that's a big part of crossover into American audiences. Mm-hmm. Fantastic production values, and this has that. When it comes to the sound, as Tosin said, when it comes to the language tracks, when it comes to the actual animation, the fast-paced stuff. And the storytelling is proven because, you know, they're on volume 11 or so in Japan and they're selling wildly. So I think they had there's a lot going for this in terms of a relatively conservative outlook in terms of its success.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to check that out. I've heard about it. You know, Netflix has obviously been hyping it up, so I just have not had a chance to check it out with all the other TV shows that I've been trying to catch up on. But that is definitely one that I'll have to check
out.
Yeah,
and I'm just really glad that they decided to sponsor an anime series.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, man, that you don't see that often.
Nope.
From
anyone, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, it's great because it's one of those things that one of the things I like about anime is that the culture that it's coming from is so different from our own that you're forced to look at the situations in with new eyes, which is kind of tight. So everyone checking it out, it's Knights of Cydonia. That's Sidonia. Don't confuse it with Knights of Cydonia, because that is a song by Muse from Britain, and you'll get confused.
Okay. Good advice. All right, let's jump into some of the hottest stories of the week here. So Google is the undisputed king of search in all but one category, product searches. Over the past decade, Amazon's transformed itself from a seller of books online to the place people turn when they want to buy, search and buy just about anything, including fresh groceries in some cities. But with each product search that starts on Amazon instead of Google, Google's main business of selling ads alongside search weakens. Google has experimented over the years with letting people buy goods with the help of services such as Google Wallet and Google Checkout. But they are expanding things coming soon with a commitment of as much as $500 million to expand their Google it's expanding their service known as Shopping Express, which was founded in 2013. Investment in the Shopping Express has gone towards the marketing of the service in each new city and the buildup of a fleet of delivery vehicles, as well as toward paying for a network of couriers and workers to pack up the goods in stores and deliver packages to shoppers' doorsteps. Unlike Amazon, Google doesn't operate its own giant warehouses or store inventory. Instead, it fulfills customer orders by picking up items from nearby retail stores. So rather than compete directly against retailers like Amazon, Google's attempting to position itself as an ally to retailers. What do you guys think about this initiative of Google to step into Amazon's footsteps and start delivering product?
This is, I think, the biggest story of the week, regardless of anything else that's around. Google is, in no small terms, it's attempting to basically disrupt Amazon, disrupt the current paradigm of online efficiency by using their massive amounts of data when it comes to mapping, when it comes to local, when it comes to search, in order to bring revenue back to local businesses. This is a coup. If it works, it'll be a coup politically, because business, like politicians always want to bring money into their districts, and by supporting Google, that's going to be a thing. And then it's also a big thing in terms of these businesses, which are looking for customer growth and can't necessarily have it. And if Google can give them volume at a relatively small diminishment of margin, then it's going to be a big success. Users can sit back and say, you know what, I want to buy local. I want to support my local area. I want to support this mom and pop or whatever. Or just like, even if it's a chain, I want to support the local economy. So I'm going to buy via Google. That way, Google's making a lot more people winners. It's making the consumer who wants to go local winner. It's making the local business owner winner. It's making the local politics winners. And it's adding to local tax dollars. These are not going to be tax-free purchases because they are local.
Sure.
So we'll see how this stacks up. Right now, they're talking about how Google spent money on marketing. There's some other stuff going on in terms of PR with Amazon that isn't so positive. And I'm talking mostly about the idea of the working conditions in these large distribution centers, the warehouses, the distribution centers. That's something that Google will be able to take on quite positively with this new focus, with this new way of fulfilling customers' needs. So if they're going to create a network of fulfillment that just focuses on picking something up from one place and bringing it to your place locally, and they can do that efficiently, that is going to be something that is very difficult to do, but based on their position, very possible. And if they can pull that off, it's really gonna move the needle in terms of the internet for local, which is something that marketers have been trying to crack for the last 5-6 years.
Yeah, I think the one thing that Amazon would still have over this would be sales tax, and although in states like mine, California, they do charge sales tax, and Amazon Prime delivery, which is still a boost over local delivery. Although the one thing the definite advantage that I could see from here is the ability to deliver items from local businesses that you can't get anywhere else. It's hard to find.
Local business items, right? And then same day delivery. So while Prime is great, and I know you can get some same day delivery express in Seattle and New York, you'll get, you might be able to get same day delivery with Google service. They clearly gotta try to figure that out. And then there's the fact that with the tax thing, you know, Amazon has some advantage with the tax thing, but it's not something that's going to last forever, and Amazon knows that. And it's also not something that that Amazon completely relies on, because when you go to, like, you're in Colorado, there's an Amazon, the Amazon fulfillment center is all around Colorado, because in the West, Colorado's where everybody lives. So those people, you know, suffer. Those people don't have to deal with taxes. But if you live in California, which is a massive state, you can't have surrounding, you can't have, you know, fulfillment centers in close proximity to any major city by having it surround the state. So New York, California, Washington State, all these places are huge population centers, and Amazon doesn't get the tax, the Amazon consumer doesn't get the tax benefit there. So in those places, Google's going to have their best chance of success when it comes to pricing.
What's really interesting is how Google Shopping Express is really seeping into everyone's life. So currently, I don't know of a state or a location where they're in where they're actually charging people anything for the shopping experience. So it's been free for – at first they said it was only going to be free for I feel like a couple months or maybe even it was 6 months. But after that period has elapsed for everyone that I know, including myself included, they've extended that. So far it's been completely free to use. It is same-day delivery in most occasions unless you are a little late or they're very backed up and busy. And it's just really useful for getting those last-minute items that you need, especially because now they've added more large businesses as well too, like Costco, you know. Think of how many people would rather just order from Google Shopping Express than wait in like long Costco lines and navigate.
Right, and Costco's got to love that because Costco's hanging out there in Seattle and where it's from, and they're losing a lot of their bulk ordering and subscription stuff from Amazon. So there's definitely space here to develop. There's space here to make inroads, and I think Google's gonna shift the market a little bit. Amazon's response to this has already come in some ways. Prime is clearly not just a function of getting your stuff quickly. It's a function of getting access to vast amounts of video and music content. In addition to that, and who knows what more. So Google will have to. I mean, Google like wants to lock this in. Amazon Shopping, Google Shopping Express with like their Google Play offerings. And you can have like your kind of Google Passport or something. That would be a more direct competitive thing. But I think that, you know, Amazon's going to have to compete in some other ways in order to make sure that they stay relevant in this space.
Right now, Google Shopping Express is limited. I just checked to see if they deliver in my area, in Los Angeles area, and they do not. Currently, the closest is San Francisco, which I'm assuming is how you're able to get it, Tosin.
Yeah, I first started off in the Bay Area and expanded to San Francisco. I actually used it recently for my Japan trip because there are a few items I needed last minute, and I was like, oh, I can just Google Shopping Express it and have it delivered to my office. So,
nice. All right, moving on here. Amazon, awash in negative publicity in its confrontation with the publisher Hachette over ebook terms, is seeking to break the standoff by appealing directly to the publisher's authors. David Nagar, a Amazon executive who works with publishers and independent authors, sent a letter this week to a small group of Hachette writers proposing, quote, a big windfall for authors by taking them out of the middle of the dispute. The letter extends and develops a proposal Amazon made earlier in the dispute, which was dismissed by Hachette. It now offers Hachette authors, quote, 100% of the sales price of every Hachette ebook we sell. Amazon is also offered to suspend all its shipping delays and price adjustments, which it put in place in an effort to bend Hachette to its will. However, Roxana Robinson, president of the Authors Guild, dismissed the proposal by saying, if Amazon wants to have a constructive conversation about this, we're ready to have one at any time, but this seems like a short-term solution that encourages authors to take sides against their publishers. It doesn't get the authors out of the middle of this. We're still in the middle. Our books are still at the center of this struggle. And researching this article, I found a commenter on Reddit who pointed out that no Hachette author can take this deal, as Amazon obviously doesn't have the legal authority to alter the contracts Hachette authors have with the publisher. That Amazon is putting this out as a PR move because they know that Hachette will never accept it. But Hachette has to be the one to accept the deal, even if it even can legally, not individual authors.
So there are a couple things here. One, that is a salient comment by that Reddit poster. That's the, one of the comments I had planned on making. The only thing I would add is that, yes, if you have a contract with Hachette and you're in contract, you're in the center of your contract, you can't simply start writing a book for Amazon or take your content out of Hachette and throw it at Amazon and say, hey, pay me. That's going to breach your contract and give you issues. If Amazon is offering to indemnify those individuals for moving, sort of like how T-Mobile says, if you quit your carrier earlier, we'll pay your early termination fee.
Yeah.
While the termination fee for such a contract is far more complex, you know, that would be a way that Amazon could do it. There's also the fact that Hachette has different types of contracts with different types of authors. So there are plenty of authors that are not in extended long contracts who haven't signed up to deliver many, many books. You know, they kind of might be, let's call it in a contributing space with Hachette. So there are people who have been working with Hachette who can leave for Amazon. The question, though, is, and this is something that I've been researching for the last day or so, is do authors want this? At the center of this situation is the idea that Amazon's trying to do right by the author by saying, hey, look, your publishing company's taking too much money from you. I can be your publishing company and I'll get your books out to the people, right? To the bystander, that sounds great. Yeah, get rid of the publishing guys. They're the middlemen who are taking all the stuff. But if you're an author, publishing offers a lot for you. And by that I mean an artist does not necessarily want to negotiate terms and all these other things like that. When you have an agent, when you have a publisher, these entities are people trained in understanding the marketplace so they can get you, the artist, the most amount of bang for your buck. And by maybe not bang for your buck, but maybe the most amount of income for your work. They're completely associated. Their incentives are aligned. Mm-hmm. Just like anything else, if I sell your book, I'm gonna take 10%. Does that mean I'm gonna say your book's marked up by 10%? Maybe, maybe not. But what I don't want is to, you know, the publisher or the agent is saying, what I don't want is for you to not focus on writing because you're worried about numbers, which is a big piece for any artist. And let's not forget that these writers are artists. Maybe if it was in the realm of journalism, it would be a little bit different. But in literature, you know, these people, like you read about George R. R. Martin or J.K. Rowling and things, they're not super concerned with the data, and nor do they want to be super concerned with the day-to-day activities of, you know, what each book is going for. They want their money. They want to be able to continue their work. Right. Now, when you also look at the fact that Amazon in this role would be both publisher, would be publisher, agent, and distributor, you end up with a situation that in the short term really helps out, may really help out the author by getting them more money, you know, that 10% or 15% more that their publisher wouldn't take. But in the long term, it doesn't help them because their negotiating position is diminished because they don't have a broker for their work. Amazon is the judge, jury, and executioner when it comes to which content, not only how much content is going to cost, but which content is necessary. Amazon, like Netflix, would simply take a look at what people are buying, and they'd put in orders for that. They'd say, hey, look, you know, don't write this. Write more vampire love drama because that's what's selling. And that would preclude us from experiencing new genres, breakout genres, new types of literature because it wasn't in the data. And that's one of the things that the artist has to be able to do. To look beyond the data to create something that consumers want. And that's one of those things where, you know, if you've got to deal with Amazon on that level, being your publisher, being your distributor, being your agent, you're really not going to be able to say no to anybody in that circle because they control basically everything that happens after you finish, you take your pen away from the paper. You need someone to advocate for you, and that's what publishing has become. Mm-hmm. And that's why that these battles exist. And it makes for arguably an inefficient market to have people sitting there saying, you know, no, you got to pay more because yada, yada, yada. But it also makes for a space that allows, you know, artists to just be artists. So there's, I don't think that what Amazon doing is doing is coming from the wrong place. But I do think that it does miss some of the point and advantage for these artists that are trying to get their work out there. There are two schools of thought. There are plenty of artists who are like, I want to self-publish. I want to manage this myself. And there are other artists who say, no, I don't want any of that. I just want to kind of show up to the book signing after I've written my thing. And both of them create great types of work. It's just it's not for everybody. So it's not a catch-all super winning situation.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would imagine any situation like this it would not be out there. There would one solution would not satisfy all. Yeah, yeah, all authors, all plaintiffs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's definitely cool, but yeah, it's something. I mean, there are lots of caveats here. So,
moving on. Okay, so Dwayne, you linked me to this profile of venture capitalist and entrepreneur Tim Draper by Rory Carroll in The Guardian. And I think this is a fascinating profile of this guy. This is the guy who he recently bought over 29,000 bitcoins that were seized last year from the illegal online drug market Silk Road. The U.S. Marshals auctioned them off, and he beat 44 rival bidders and scooped the whole lot up. And he plans to partner with Bitcoin exchange Varuum. Am I saying that right? Varuum.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And use the Bitcoins to launch trading platforms in emerging markets vulnerable to volatile currencies and weak banking institutions. And he's also championing a ballot initiative to separate California into six smaller states. He says that currently California is bureaucratically cumbersome, unwieldy, and chasing away businesses. The reason California is acting as a monopoly, the government isn't taking care of its people. He says, and the solution to poverty and creaking infrastructure was to enhance local autonomy and market forces. As one of the envisaged six states, Silicon Valley itself would be its own state and would be one of the richest in the U.S. And the newly liberated Central Valley would be one of the poorest.
New Vegas. This sounds like a game.
Yeah. So this guy, I bring him up because just like in some ways, you know, it's not too different from Amazon's recent move and Google's recent moves. He's trying to disrupt the current. He's trying to like disrupt our current situation, our current like status quo when it comes to the way we look at finance, currency, and the way we look at government. So right now he looks at things and he's like, hey, look, Bitcoin's great because it frees us from fiat, you know, fiat government and all that stuff. That's a good thing. Fiat currency and all that stuff. It rests its value on what people actually think it's worth, and you can use it for anything you want. So, you know, that's where he's coming from with this kind of like super hardcore, you know, market-driven laissez-faire focus on the Bitcoin. The interesting thing to me is that his idea of breaking up California into six different, you know, states essentially is really, really radical for a host of reasons, not the least of which is, you know, it would basically impoverish much of California's current existence for the sake of turning certain smaller groups into really wealthy groups. But at the same time, he does highlight that the California governing body, the government, is not able to fully take advantage or fully focus on those things that would make Silicon Valley grow more quickly. Right? He's impatient. He wants to see Silicon Valley grow quickly and move into its ascendancy. And frankly, a lot of people in Silicon Valley want that too. Our economy is based on software and services. And a lot of that software comes out of California, not just software as in terms of like programs and apps and so on. It's also in terms of You know, movies, TV shows, that's also software. And the idea that LA would become its own thing and Silicon Valley would become its own thing and the Sanctuary Valley would become its own thing and so on and so forth, that does make sense from an economic perspective raw. But the social impact is kind of where I think, as a drill downer, I look at the technocrat way of solving a problem, and I love it. But then I look at the social ramifications, and I'm like, "Oh, it's too bad," because it would destroy a lot of lives.
Sure.
You know? So yeah, this is definitely, you know, it's an interesting guy, and I don't think he stands alone. I think he's a big dude, a big profile guy, high profile guy that has, you know, these ideas about separating Silicon Valley out. There are many people who believe that Northern and Southern California should be different states. That, you know, perhaps LA should figure out its water situation on its own, or that kind of thing. But at the same time, it's unlikely to happen. But I think there are a lot of people who are behind this. He's also got something different in terms of disruption. He wants to create his own college, and his college is focused directly on the needs of workers in the economy.
I thought this was one of the most interesting aspects of this article, as the article describes it as a cross between Hogwarts and Professor Xavier's, you know, school for gifted youngsters.
Right. So he basically described my high school, my K-12 school, which is what that is. But the way he looks at it is that it's all focused on entrepreneurship, which is great. And, you know, the country is peopled by individuals who run small business. You know, we hear about these big companies, we talk about them all the time in the drill down, but small businesses are the vast majority of businesses. So there are a lot of entrepreneurs that are out there. He's trying to make it so that we get more people working for themselves and not working for others. And frankly, on some level, that's where a lot of labor analysts see things going, a freelance economy, things like that. So he's got really great ideas. I think they may be ahead of our time. And he has to really work out some of the kinks. Like, you can't leave the Central Valley starved of water, or whatever, that kind of thing. But yeah, definitely great ideas here. And, they clearly need to, you know, when you look at the world and where it's going, they clearly need to be heavily refined in order to make them passable for most of the country.
Yeah, I agree there. I mean, you know, a lot of people there are probably still a lot of people who think the South should succeed and be its own, or that we should let Texas be its own sort of free. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, Texas Constitution allows them to break up into five states pretty quickly. Like a California ballot measure, yeah, what would that do? Okay, many people, everybody voted. You still have to figure out what five states are. It'd be years and years and years. Mm-hmm. The Texas Constitution, many people say it allows Texas to secede from the Union. It doesn't. It allows Texas to break into five separate states because Texas was so incredibly large when it joined the Union. It still is. And basically, he wants to apply that to California, which is, you know, again, really interesting. There's got to be a way to focus the economies of the several states around it. There's also the fact that, on some level, you know, politically, what would that do to the map in Washington, which desperately needs to be changed? But, you know, we have 100 senators. We have 435 members of the House of Representatives. You know, what happens to the House of Representatives when these new districts are drawn and suddenly someone who's been safely Democrat or safely Republican has to deal with the fact that their district is now cut in two, bisected across two states? We have to open up senators for – you know, 8 new senators, basically, or 10 new senators for 5 new states. That's a thing, too. What does that do to the political map? What does it do to the electoral map? There are ramifications that are huge, you know? So
Yeah, can we fit that many more stars on the flag?
Yeah, although we can. I think we've got enough room to fit lots and lots of stars on the flag. The only trick is each star has to get a little smaller.
Funny you mentioned that, Tosin, because I've seen a couple of articles and even a couple of online apps that demonstrate how additional stars can be added to the flag if necessary and how they would geometrically sort of balance each other out in the field.
Yeah, the design is interesting. For me, I look at those articles and I say, you know what? The flag has never been static, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It started out with a circle of 13 stars on it, and it grew and grew and grew until it looks like how it does today. But one of my complaints with sort of this – one of my complaints about looking to the old is that, you know, on some level, the best part about America is that it continues to change. And I suppose if I were you know, if I were really heavy into like traditions and stuff, I'd worry about that. But the fact is, our traditions have changed. Everything about this country changes, and it'd be great to reflect that in the flag. You know, I don't know. I looked at an article the other day. It was on VentureBeat and had the very various ways that Superman is dressed over the last 70 years or so.
Uh-huh.
I thought of the American flag and how it's changed that way too, because he very much embodies America.
Sure, sure. Yeah,
so
yeah. Let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. I just recommend this book because why the hell not? This is one of my, you know, this was a highly influential book. Not both in Philip K. Dick's oeuvre and also influential in science fiction. This book became the basis for the movie Blade Runner, which is a classic science fiction film right now. However, the book is vastly different from the movie. If you've seen both, if you read both the book and seen the movie, You know that the book was sort of like a launching off point for the film. It's basically about a cop in the future. In the book, it's 2021, and he's got a license to kill. The book takes place in San Francisco, somewhere out there in San Francisco. Amongst the hordes of humans are several rogue androids, and Rick Deckard's assignment is to find them and, quote, retire them. So are you guys familiar with this book at all?
Yeah, I definitely know of it.
I think of it as kind of a novella rather than like a whole big book. It's, sure. It's really quite short. It really gets to the point really quickly. And, you know, like many of Philip K. Dick's things, his general idea was to, you know, start off with a premise, see where I can take it. And then a lot of people kind of run with him. He makes stuff that makes for good remixes, and I think that's why Blade Runner was so awesome. But it's a great little book.
Tosin, what were you gonna say?
No, I've definitely heard of it as well. I just haven't had the chance to read it. It's on that list of epic books that I need to check out. So
absolutely,
this might be a good way for me to listen to it.
It's totally worth it. Yeah, yeah. And this particular production is done by one of Audible's regular cast stable of narrator Scott Brick, and Scott Brick is usually pretty good at with most things that he narrates. And Dwayne was saying, one of the best things about Philip K. Dick's work is that it's all of his stuff is very existential. Like it all makes you sort of inwardly cogitate on the nature of humanity and what it's like to be human and whether or not you are in your own existence or not. It's very thought-provoking. So I highly recommend that. In order to download that free audiobook today or any one of Audible's 100,000-plus other titles, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. And the 30-day trial to check out their service. Using that URL helps us out on the show, so please do that. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can cancel it, and you still get to keep Blade Runner or Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep for free. The Audible site retitled the offering as Blade Runner because I think it's just how it's better known. All right, we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, a new rule you'll need to know next time you plan on bringing electronics on board a plane. So take a listen to this and come on back. if you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. Ordinary internet users, American and non-American alike, far outnumber legally targeted foreigners in the communications intercepted by the NSA from U.S. digital networks, according to a four-month investigation by the Washington Post. 9 of 10 account holders found in a large cache of intercepted conversations, which former NSA contractor Edward Snowden provided to the Post, were not the intended surveillance targets, but were caught in a net the agency had cast for someone else. Many of them were Americans. Nearly half the surveillance files contained names, email addresses, or other details of the NSA marked as belonging to U.S. citizens or residents. NSA analysts masked or minimized more than 65,000 such references to protect Americans' privacy, but the Washington Post found nearly 900 additional email addresses unmasked in the files that could strongly be linked to U.S. citizens or U.S. residents. NSA is doing these targeted searches for foreigners, but the collateral data that they're gathering for all of these searches are bringing in essentially non-targeted Americans. What do you guys think about this?
It's uncomfortable. Sketchy.
But I mean, did we expect less?
I mean, unfortunately, I expect less because I had hoped that, you know, they were following the rules. But it's just clear that overreach is a huge part of this growing surveillance state. And I'm mostly sad that this isn't the kind of thing that is on Meet the Press, on Fox News. You know, maybe Fox News because they have a libertarian bent to them. But really, like, this is – it's out of control how many non-legally targeted people are being surveilled just for the sake of whatever.
Yeah, it sounds like even when they're following the the proper procedure, that the collateral damage to this is just unconscionable. It's certainly not what U.S. citizens would expect or want from these searches.
Yeah, it's so I feel like this is one of those stories that's continually breaking, and we have to kind of just follow it. But the Post saw roughly 160,000 intercepted emails and instant message conversation. Some of them were hundreds of pages long from more than 11,000 online accounts. That's just a lot more than I feel like the FISA court has allowed. And it's disturbing.
So that's a very good point. In terms of the scope of what's officially allowed.
Yeah.
That is a great point.
In related news, it was revealed this week by The Intercept that the NSA and the FBI have been covertly monitoring the emails of prominent Muslim Americans, including a political candidate and several civil rights activists, academics, and lawyers under secretive procedures intended to target terrorists and foreign spies. Some of the included in the list of Americans monitored by the NSA includes Faisal Gill, a longtime Republican Party operative and one-time candidate for public office. This is a guy who held a top secret security clearance and served in the Department of Homeland Security under President Bush. Asim Ghaffour, a prominent attorney who has represented clients in terrorism-related cases. Hushang Amira Mahdi, an Iranian-American professor at Rutgers. These are people who have all led highly public, outwardly exemplary lives, and they all of them deny involvement in terrorism or espionage, and none of them advocate violent jihad or is known to have been implicated in any crime despite years of intense scrutiny by the government and press. In the case of Faisal Gill, the first person I mentioned, they've climbed the ranks of U.S. national security and foreign policy establishments.
This is pretty disturbing, too. The only thing I can really say about it is that I'm eerily reminded of J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah.
And like Martin Luther King, and the fact that they look at, here's one guy here who... Faisal Gill, the longtime Republican Party operative, is now being tracked by the FBI and NSA simply because he's Muslim. This is one of those things where you're watching that that CIA movie with Matt Damon, and he says, everybody who doesn't look like me is basically visiting in America because it's our country. And that's what bothers me, this idea that like because he looks a certain way, because his background is different, he has to be surveilled even though he's beyond, you know, beyond all the standards of regular citizenship, patriotism recognition.
It's profiling. It's essentially the same thing. You're right. It's the same thing that the FBI used to do under J. Edgar Hoover. The CIA did for years in the 60s with black rights advocates. And now we see it here today with the NSA and the FBI against Muslim Americans.
You would have hoped we have moved further from that given the lengthy history of such things.
Yeah.
And, sadly, things haven't changed.
It's just clear that technology has moved us in a fantastic manner over the last, 10, 15 years, especially the last 5 years. The NSA and the FBI are using that to their advantage too. The problem is we always complain about where technology like isn't catching up to the law. And this is a place where the law or the law enforcement is in many ways past the current. The law enforcement's use of technology is past where the current law is and where people are comfortable using it. It's a pain point, I think. And I think we're going to have to take up a certain level of activism in order to make sure that this pain point doesn't stay this way, that we can have the world as we want the world to be, not have to give up things for it, give up our freedoms for it. But I do think this is a pain point. I do think on some level, we the people can work to make sure that the government isn't using technology outside of the scope that our elected officials who are making laws for us say that it should be used outside of. Right. This is, again, one of those stories that needs to be chased up by the media because it's just out of line.
I imagine we won't hear the end of this.
Or maybe we will because the government will say stop talking about it.
Yeah.
And NBC will say, okay.
International travelers will have to make sure they charge all of their devices before boarding their flights. An announcement made Sunday, the TSA now plans on blocking flyers with uncharged phones and electronic devices at certain undisclosed airports in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. In addition to other forms of screening, passengers will need to prove their devices can actually turn on before flying. According to NBC News, the new security measures are being made in an effort to stop an Al-Qaeda terror plot aimed at blowing up an airliner. Officials are reportedly concerned that a laptop, smartphone, or tablet might be used as a bomb. Passenger shoes will also be scrutinized at checkpoints, as they currently are.
Yeah, this is interesting because it's I kind of get it, right? I mean, how many times have we seen somebody open up a book in a film and pull out a gun, right? Because it's not really a book. This makes sense. Like, does it turn on? Does it work? Does it whatever? Our micro devices are really micro because every single inch of them is packed with just exactly what they need in order to work. So if you were to – that's one of the reasons why they scan laptops, because laptops do have a little leeway. But iPads, iPhones, those things, there's not really a lot of space for you to be able to turn them on and still put in fissible materials that will – fusionable materials that will explode. Those aren't the words I should have used. Unless like maybe there's some way to make a super micro explosive and only have half the size of the battery you need in there to turn it on, which is an engineering feat. They're basically, once again, making it harder. And, as much as I hate taking off my shoes in the airplane, I do think that this is one of the things where they should have gone earlier. Like, does your stuff work or is it just decoy stuff so you can explode it? Like, put three phones together or open up the back of three phones, put some chemicals together and explode them in the plane and, like, make a breach that makes the plane crash or whatever. This is one of those things that its time has come.
Yeah, I mean, it clearly makes sense. I think for the average traveler, you will have your devices charged. The only cases that I can see is if you've gone somewhere internationally and you don't remember, you have no means of charging it. But I think that's probably a rare case. And most of the times you do want your things charged before you go on planes to use them. So I don't think it's going to be that much of a concern for most people unless they start forcing people to turn on devices, because then it's just going to be
a long time. They're going
to
have you, you know, swipe left to unlock your phone or something like that, I think, out of these airports. And it's not every airport. It's just certain places where
they think
it's easy ways for baddies to get through and into Europe and into the U.S. But I do think people will be making you swipe your phone to see if it's open, crack open your laptop, see if it turns on. I think that'll definitely be happening.
Well, make sure you get to the airport early then.
Right, exactly.
And charge up your devices. For sure.
Well, this is a great, like, if you've been on Amazon, I don't know about you guys, maybe my, if you go on Amazon right now and look up external battery for iPhone,
yeah,
you get about 90 different options, right? I've got one that'll do my iPad twice and my iPhone four times, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've got another one that's really small that I use when I'm skiing, because between the phone calls, the Bluetooth, and the hard to reach reception, the battery can get down to like 30% at the end of a day, and then you've got a whole another rest of the evening to hang out, that kind of thing. So those guys, you know, for traveling, those devices are great, and you know, this is just another reason for those guys to sell their wares. Unfortunately, it means redistributing money from people's pockets into like these kinds of vendors, but you know, I guess that's part of the economy. Of death and destruction in the sky.
I mean, obviously, everything about what the TSA is doing is inconvenient to the traveler, but it's just a little inconvenient to know that not only on top of all the other things that you have to check for and take your shoes off and be prepared to submit to, that now you have to be you might be set aside and searched individually if you happen to forget to recharge your laptop.
Here's an idea. How about at the airport you actually get slippers? So when you take off your shoes, you keep slippers on, and you can go on a plane wearing slippers. Because, you know, if long flights, people like to take off their shoes.
A lot of people do that.
I like that idea, Tosin.
Die Hard? Yeah.
Tosin, I'm writing that down.
Yeah. I've heard of a lot of people who do that, or at the very least have slip-on shoes, so that's easier.
Yeah, I mean, people have slip-on shoes, but I hate slip-on shoes. I don't want to walk around town with slip-on shoes. They slip off my feet. In fact, I tend to wear laced boots most of the time. They're not like combat boots or anything hardcore like that. But I wear laces. I wear like Onitsuka Tigers, and I wear boots, and I just wear laces. And I'm kind of like, I'm used to it. I'm down. I do fly a lot. So I'm always in a plane, and I'm always like taking my stuff off. But you know, I've got like status or whatever on my airline. Like, it'd be great if I could go to the lounge and, you know, get a pair of slippers like I would in a hotel and walk around that part of the airport with it, you know?
Because mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For me, I don't like walking in the street with my feet out, you know, slippy kind of things. I don't like proper shoes. But in like that section of the airport, I would be down for that. Like, you know, you go to security, you put your foot in some, you know, you get into the airport, you put your foot in some slippers, you walk through, you're good. I don't know. There's something there. I don't know if that's the answer, but that's definitely a helpful thing, especially if they're issue-type slippers, so you know exactly what's up with the slipper, what you should be getting out of, like, a mass spectrometer or something.
Sure, sure, sure.
I just, back on the other line, I just hope I'm never pulled aside, because I carry so many electronic devices that, even for my Japan trip, I carried a spare external hard drive that was in an enclosure, you know, in a typical hard drive enclosure. So,
yeah, have to
boot up all that stuff. DS. Yeah.
Well, when they scan that, they scan the hard drives. Cause last time I went to India, I brought a hard drive, and they scanned all that stuff. And what I did get was, because of the external batteries, the jam box, this or that, I did get they had a lithium worry. There's a lot of lithium I was traveling with, because everything's lithium powered, and they were like, you know, lithium is kind of an explosive, you know, material. But for the most part, the whole thing with all the electronics was that they were able to see that a hard drive was a hard drive. Right, they were able to like see through the plastic and stuff like that, so you don't have to worry about that. It is funny when I did once get on a plane with a subwoofer, and that was an issue, because the subwoofer I didn't want to put in the it was an old Logitech subwoofer, and I didn't want to put it in the storage underneath the plane because I didn't have a proper box for it, so I just used it as my carry on, and there was a lot of talking about that one.
All right, we're going to take one last break here. And when we come back, before you think about adding that stranger as a friend, you're going to want to see our drill down video of the week. So take a listen to this and come on back. You're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Adefowakan. A new video hit the web this week featuring what's purported to be the new sapphire front screen for Apple's upcoming iPhone 6. Uploaded to YouTube by tech vlogger Marques Brownlee, the video takes an up-close look at the purported display and attempts to scratch, bend, and break the part. This display performed surprisingly well and came out of testing unscathed. Brownlee said the components made of sapphire crystal and came straight off of Apple's assembly line in Asia. Whatever it's made of, the rumored component looks to be both extremely hard and adequately pliable, possibly to the point of negating the need for a screen protector, at least according to Marques. We've all seen this video. What are your thoughts, guys?
Very resilient, and that's one of the things that I love about, you know, even the current generation of the devices. I do have some slight chips and things that I've been noticing on my phone, mm-hmm. but I'm one of those people that doesn't use a case because I just I'm fairly careful with my device in terms of I've never cracked a screen, you know, knock on wood, but I just like having the same look and aesthetic as what the device it should be without having to bulk it up, because I just slip these things in my pocket with, you know, other items. So I just love the resiliency that they was able to demonstrate with it, as well as the clarity.
I don't know. I look at this thing, and this could very well. I mean, it's difficult, obviously, you know, post production CGI to do all that kind of stuff on the budget that this guy's working with. So this thing, you know, if this is a product for a real telephone, it is incredibly resistant to normal wear and tear, or a hardy wear and tear, as he shows. The issue, I think, with iOS devices for the last two cycles hasn't been – well, not two cycles, but the last two phones hasn't been whether or not the screen's going to crack. I haven't seen it much of an iPhone 5 or 5S screen crack. What I have seen is the metal on the side is what gets fucked up. That all gets knackered and knocked, especially those fools who went out and got a black iPhone 5. It's all like silver on the sides and scratches. Instead of and that's one of the reasons why they advertise on the 5S. They realized how much that happened on the 5, and the advertisements for the 5S are all a white phone because of that. It doesn't show as much. I'm a case guy. I always have been. Part of that's just because my phone is only my phone for a year. Then I give it to, you know, my girlfriend or somebody else, and I want them to have something that looks reasonably newish. But this video, you know, as rumors go, it's more solid than almost anything I've ever read on 9to5 Mac or Mac Rumors or anything like that, and that's a big thing for me. I look at this and I kind of feel like what we're seeing here is possibly, you know, this new generation of people going out and finding these things instead of just writing about it or saying a person familiar with the whatever matter has to say it. They're taking video, they're putting it online, and they're letting you judge for yourselves. And I think that that's a much better way. It's almost more journalistic than just kind of being, oh, someone familiar with the matter, I had two sources, whatever. When it comes to stuff like this kind of hardware, let's just see it. Let's just see what it's like. Show me the hardware.
I think that's probably one of the keys to this guy's popularity. We were talking during the break about this this tech vlogger, Marques Brownlee, and how popular his YouTube channel is. And essentially all he does is basically tech reviews, and he's got this huge following of subscribers, a million, 1.4 million subscribers. And I think part of it is that he just basically shows you this. He shows you the goods. Okay, our drill down video of the week. Now, this video you can file under bizarre, viral, literally marketing. If you're a Polish Facebook user and you received a friend request from someone you didn't know and you added that person as a friend, you might have also received permission to view this video. And it's a video of a it's basically a first-person POV video of someone at a bar meeting a nice girl, seemingly a nice girl, sharing drinks with her, taking her back home, stripping her down and starting to have sex with her. And then you get this unusual sort of on-screen text that says, she has HIV. She's HIV positive, and now you are too. And this is a public service announcement from the Polish Red Cross Foundation. And I think that was an interesting – the interesting aspect about this is, first of all, it's kind of a bizarre ad campaign to begin with. But that it disseminated itself specifically by linking to – by basically – being part of a friend request of a as a stranger. Like if you added someone as who was a stranger as a friend on Facebook, you got this video.
In the marketing sense, this is an incredibly integrated marketing campaign. It's a social native marketing campaign. And what they've basically done is they tied the content, which is the video, to the distribution method, which wasn't standard. I'm going to buy ads on Facebook or whatever. Yeah. It was, I'm not going to call it grassroots, but it was earned media exposure. I'm going to go out and I'm going to friend request, 100,000 people. And for the people who accept my friend request, even though they have no idea who I am, I'll make up a fake profile, do whatever. Then I'll just link this video and they'll watch it and think it's really awesome and then they'll realize what's up. And I think it's particularly powerful if it gets distributed that way, because you're like, oh, I don't – when it comes to a friend request, cute girl online, whatever. Yeah. I mean, online is a big way that people meet and decide to hook up. And there are obviously dangerous situations that happen with sex and online and all that stuff. But online also seems relatively innocuous when you compare it to so many other ways of linking up with people if you're just going to communicate online. So basically they're saying, hey, you picked up this person on Facebook. That's great. When you're out in the real world, there are real consequences.
Right.
And I think that level of social integration is pretty powerful. I think it's going to be pretty powerful to youngsters who grew up in an age where AIDS wasn't the big deal it was, if you're in your mid-30s today. AIDS, when I was a kid, AIDS was something that you were just afraid of,
Sure.
You were just like, it was just after the country got out of got away from the myth that it was a gay-only disease.
Right,
and
right.
About when it the reality hit that it was definitely tied to income and certain class aspects, and definitely in certain communities or whatever. But just the fact that it could be anywhere, anyone could have it. You couldn't tell. It takes years for it to show up. Once you get it doesn't stop. All these scary things still are very, very scary. And before these years of drugs to help, mitigate the effects of HIV. So I look at this ad and I think it's a nice punch in the jaw for some of the youth out there that didn't have access to that level of fear and thus discipline about drugs. And also, when you think about Europe, the incidence of HPV and some other diseases is, it's not low. People get curable V, venereal infections all the time, which means they're having unprotected sex. And if Poland wants to really stop stop this from happening. These are the kinds of things that can reach out to people. So it's a great video to watch because it's entertaining. And you're like, okay, I get it. It's going a little far. Oh, okay, I get it.
It's
like the situation.
It's very reminiscent to me. It was very reminiscent to me of the Prodigy's 1997 video for Smack My Bitch Up. I don't know if you've seen that video.
No. I've never seen a video called Smack My Bitch Up.
I'll send you the link for that one because that one is worthwhile seeing, and the less I say about that, the better. But you should. But if you decide to watch it, watch the entire thing.
You know what's kind of interesting is the sort of change in advertising that we've been seeing from a lot of these. A lot of these type of companies, right, for things like AIDS, for things like smoking and drugs, they've really – for, you know, drinking and driving, they've really, like, hyped it up, turned it another level where they're bringing back that sort of fear factor but in a unique sort of way. Fear or disgusting factor, I guess, in some regards. But
in a generation-appropriate, medium-appropriate kind of way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, check it out. We've got it linked in our show notes. And I believe that is it for our show, with the exception of going around the table here. And I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on The Drill Down?
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DwayneD. You can also check out Random Thoughts on DwayneDNYC.blogspot.com. Temporary space for some random thoughts. And recently I've been doing some writing on VentureBeat.com, threw something together about the songs purchased by Google the other day, and there's other stuff in there about just life stuff like smart calendars, whatever. So that's where I am. How about you, Tosin?
You can find me on twitter.com/toast4321. You can find my other ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com. There will be R2D2 updates at some point at toastr2d2.tumblr.com. Just trying to get through all the Japan photos and get those stuff up first. So if you add me on Facebook, or at least I'll make sure those are open on Facebook so people can view those as well, too. Yes. You're not going to get infected with Japan. Well, you might get infected with Japan fever.
You won't be HIV positive.
I got infected with Japan.
Right.
Where can we find your work, Andrew?
Well, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, or just do a search on Google for Mr. Babyman. That's my social media handle, and all my social media work is there online for you to see. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, you can always send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing and loyal audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.